And you are listening to Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Imagine your house, your everyday surroundings, the things you use every day, to be not mass-produced objects made by disinterested worker pawns and soulless factories, but rather to be works of artistic value, items made carefully and thoughtfully using natural materials and traditional methods. That kind of imagining is not some far-flung, impossible enterprise. In fact, it formed the basis of an enormously influential movement in design and architecture, a movement called Arts and Crafts. And while Arts and Crafts flourished in the late 1880s and early 1900s, its legacy lives on in the thousands of craftsmen bungalows in the Bay Area and beyond, in the buildings of Frank Lloyd Wright and Bernard Maybeck, and in originals and reproductions of furnishings, textiles, pottery, and other items made or inspired by the likes of Gustav Stickley or the Roycrofters. And while, of course, the aesthetics of the movement continue to amaze and inspire consumers and collectors, the sometimes radical philosophical and political ideas that informed it are worth remembering and discussing as well. Joining us now is Martin Chapman. He's a consulting curator for European Decorative Arts with the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, and he's also the guest curator for the current exhibition entitled International Arts and Crafts, William Morris to Frank Lloyd Wright. And welcome, Martin.
Hello.
Hi. Tell us a little bit about the Arts and Crafts movement. What was it primarily about?
Well, it was a movement which was united by ideals because it had such a broad spread from Britain and Europe and across America and even to Japan. It isn't something that really has a single style attached to it. It's a lot of different styles, a lot of different manifestations. What binds the arts and crafts together is its ideals, and these are ideals of integrity to do with craftsmanship, to do with materials, truth to materials themselves, and an interest in the materials and a respect for the artists involved. Craftsmen were no longer seen as cogs in an industrial wheel, but on a raised up to a level above, along with artists and sculptors.
The arts and crafts movement emerged and flourished in Britain in the 1880s. What was the impetus there? What critique of current methods of production, say, motivated the founders of this movement?
Well, I think very strongly it was a reaction against the Industrial Revolution and the ill effects of the Industrial Revolution. Britain was the most powerful country in the world in the 1850s, and at the very moment they were celebrating their might with the famous Crystal Palace exhibition of 1851, which was meant to be the works of industry of all nations brought together under one roof. This was effectively the world's first first World's Fair. British goods were being criticized for the poor execution of their works and the inappropriate decoration. So that, in terms of goods, was one heavy criticism for the quality of British goods. But there was also something underlying this which was really much more important and ran deeply in the culture, which was a reaction against the unfortunate effects of industrialization, of the ugly towns, of the grey, smoky effects, and of course on the towns, I'm sorry to say, and also on society in general. Poverty and social deprivation.
Now, didn't good craftsmanship, working with natural materials, adherence to traditional artistic methods, didn't that exist before the craftsman movement?
Well, it, to a certain extent, yes, it had existed before, and I think that what Ruskin and Morris were advocating, and to a certain extent Pugin, was looking back to a past, to an idealized past of the medieval world, where the craftsman was high on the rung of the ladder, the ladder of hierarchy, when coming to make great Gothic cathedrals and so on. So there is a certain looking back to the idealized world of the Gothic world with its guilds, particularly, which held the craftsmen together.
You just mentioned John Ruskin and William Morris. We'll talk about William Morris in detail later in this show. Who were some of the other primary movers and shakers of the arts and crafts movement, say, in the U.S.?
In the U.S., we're looking at Stickley, for example, and his Craftsman Workshop you've already mentioned, because he really did make the arts and crafts or the craftsman's works available to a wider public, and that was his great success. But on the West Coast, I think that the person who is most interesting, coming through as being most interesting, is the Reverend Worcester, who was behind the Swedenborgian Church in the Bay Area.
Right, and this is a Swedenborgian church on Lion Street in San Francisco. It still stands today. Well, tell us a little bit about this Worcester.
Well, the Reverend Worcester was interested in Swedenborgian ideals, but he wanted to bring it into some form of manifestation in his new church in Pacific Heights, which was meant to be a union of art and nature and spirituality. And in order to do so, he pulled together several personalities here, A. Page Brown, who was an architect, William Keith, the painter, California Impressionist painter, Bernard Maybeck, who acted as a draftsman on it, and Bruce Porter was the stained glass artist, to mention just a few of the personalities involved in this extraordinary structure in Pacific Heights.
William Morris, one of the key founders of the arts and crafts movement, he set up his own design company, and they made lots of items for lots of people. And I wonder to what extent these arts and crafts proponents, despite perhaps their critique of mass production, really ended up making things in large quantities in small amounts of time for, obviously, customers who really wanted this stuff. To what extent could they avoid sort of the mass production feeling?
Well, handmade objects, obviously, as you say. In the range of the Sussex chair, which was Morris & Company's most successful range of furniture, these were simple, light pieces of furniture made in a traditional way, which nevertheless suited aesthetically the look of an arts and crafts house, and were remarkably cheap, and produced, by the way, by Morris & Company right up to its closure in 1940. Cheap, easily handmade by traditional methods, and yet also a successful line. It sort of sounds a bit like what the Bauhaus was trying to do and never succeeded in doing.
A lot of people might not know that arts and crafts moved on to Japan. It was called the Mingei, if I'm correct, pronouncing it correctly, or folk crafts movement. It flourished between 1926 and 1945. What do we need to know about that movement?
Well, it acts in a slightly different time frame from the rest, because it doesn't really start officially until 1926. And what's interesting about it is a rediscovery for the Japanese of their folk crafts, and using those folk crafts as inspiration for a whole new generation of craft making, particularly pottery. But despite the fact this was a discovery of Japanese and indeed Korean traditional folk crafts, it was also, to a certain extent, a fusion of West and East. And in the room set that we have a reconstruction of this on display, it shows how an idealized way of living in 1926, which shows Western dining table with a Japanese living room. And there is an element in the Mingei movement of a fusion of East meets West. One of the theories is that the major figures behind the Mingei movement, such as Yanagi, were very much influenced by the writings of Ruskin and William Morris in the early stages. And, of course, there was the British potter, Bernard Leach, who was fascinated by discovering raku, went back to England, set up his own Potterius and Ives, which in turn influenced a generation of Japanese potters. So there's an interesting cycle going on here, but right at the center of it is the rediscovery of Japanese folk crafts.
We move now to discuss a very prominent figure of the arts and crafts movement, a 19th century Englishman named William Morris, who articulated a critique of industrial society, promoted for a time a socialist agenda, and created and designed fabrics, wallpaper, and many other items that are still in great demand now, more than a century after his death. William Morris was a poet, an artist, a writer, a designer, an activist. He's a complex figure, and he's joining us now to help make sense of the man and his ideas is Peter Stansky. Peter is an emeritus professor of history at Stanford University, who has done a lot of research and writing about William Morris. Peter Stansky's books include Redesigning the World, William Morris, the 1880s and the Arts and Crafts, and From William Morris to Sergeant Pepper, Studies in the Radical Domestic. Welcome, Peter, to Against the Grain.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about the young William Morris. He was born in 1834 into a wealthy family in a village near London. Tell us about the young William Morris and what might have presaged his later inclinations with regard to design or philosophy or politics.
Well, he was a very precocious child, excuse me, and he began to read very early. He read the novels of Sir Walter Scott. As been alluded to already, the medieval strain. He was already very interested in the medieval world, and the charming thing is that his family made for him a little suit of armor, which I think is still on display in the William Morris Gallery at Walthamstow in London. And he would go riding about in the Epping Forest, which the grandest house that the family had was in the Epping Forest. And I think he had this sense of nature. He had a sense of the past. He had a particular interest in medievalism. And then also that was reinforced when he went away to the boarding school called Marlborough, where he would roam quite a bit in the forest nearby. And I think these were very important. His reading, his experiences with nature, his interest in the medieval world began very early. He then went on to Oxford. Where again, Oxford was in the process of being rebuilt, much to his distress. But there was a lot of the medieval Oxford, there's still some of it, that remained and intrigued him. And so he had a sense of the past, which was very, very important to him from the very beginning.
For people who don't know a lot about medieval art or architecture or methods, what is the essence of perhaps a principle or an idea that William Morris developed out of his love for medievalism?
Well, I think the two obvious things were, of course, it's years before the Industrial Revolution. So there's no, everything that is manufactured is manufactured by hand. Although Morris's relationship with industry is a complex one, and it changed a bit as he went on. But by definition, everything was made by hand, and the great triumphs, of course, and great works of art, and particularly great works of architecture, most notably the cathedrals. And he toured the cathedrals, not only the cathedrals of England, but he took several trips with his great friend, who became a great painter, Edward Burne-Jones, who was a contemporary and his closest friend at Oxford. They took trips to see the cathedrals of northern France, which, of course, were also very important in the writings of John Ruskin. So it was the craft, but also, as Martin Chapman mentioned, it was the idea of the guild, the idea of a group of workmen working together. And he was, and the point of this is intriguing. He was very taken with the anonymity. That the craftsman I mean, obviously some medieval craftsmen may be remembered, but basically they were unknown by name masters who nevertheless were dedicated to creating beautiful objects. Morris himself, though in many ways he could be called a Renaissance man because of the multiplicity of his interests, was anti-Renaissance. He was anti the cult of the individual. He was anti, he thought it was a group effort. And of course, he was very paradoxical in the sense that he himself was obviously an extraordinarily strong and strong-minded individual. But yet, he always was trying to get away from that. He was trying to submerge himself, unsuccessfully in his own personal case, in the group. But he had great respect for the group enterprise, and that's what deeply attracted him in the medieval period. I think he was a realist. He realized that life was nasty, brutish, and short. And in many ways, people had greater opportunities in the 19th century. But he thought that this group effort and efforts by hand really created better art.
Mm. Well, the Industrial Revolution certainly promoted a kind of anonymity among those who manufactured products in assembly line factories. What was his critique of the Industrial Revolution and what it did to society?
Well, you raise a very interesting point in the sense that you're right that the workers are anonymous, but they're anonymous in a totally uninvolved way. As the great historian of Britain, E.P. Thompson, in his brilliant biography of William Morris, has said that in his view, Morris is a greater theorist of alienation and reification than Marx. And where Morris was aware that the connection between the workman and the work within the concept of the Industrial Revolution was practically non-existent. There was no personal. I mean, the irony of the medieval situation is that even though the name was unknown, it was that person's work. That person had created the object and also cooperated in a far more meaningful way, obviously, than somebody in a factory had cooperated together and was not working on a machine. Of course, the famous 19th century conception of the worker was as a hand, and a hand that is useful in creating a machine, in working a machine, not a person. And I think that was the crucial thing for Morris.
You referred, Peter, to the sort of alienation in the Industrial Revolution of the worker from the object, the product manufactured. What about what William Morris thought about the effect of the Industrial Revolution and even capitalism on just social conditions and the way people lived and worked and gaps between rich and poor, for example?
Well, that actually sort of happened, although it was implied in his career from the very beginning. But his political career didn't go into sort of high gear until the 1870s. And so in a broader sense, I don't think he thought that much. This may be slightly unfair, but I don't think he thought that much about the actual condition of the worker until later on. But he became increasingly concerned with the poverty. Britain was both, as Martin Chapman mentioned, Britain was the wealthiest country in the world, the most powerful country in the world. You know, there are analogies with our own country today. And in which there was still intense and continuing poverty. And also he felt that this poverty was combined with meretricious surroundings, meretricious and ugly objects, that people were living in ugly environments. He and Burne Jones committed themselves when they were undergraduates at Oxford to fighting what they called shoddy in the world, At first they thought, which was the sort of conventional way for young men of the middle classes or upper middle classes who were at Oxford, that they would become ministers of the church. Becoming Church of England ministers was a way for people who wanted to live an intellectual life to have an income and have some probably rather slight duties. But in fact, Morris quite soon lost his faith, had no interest in that, and spent some time really finding quite his niche in artistic sense, because he first thought he would be an architect, and he apprenticed himself to the great one of the so-called great Goth architects, G.E. Street. The very important thing about that is that there he met a contemporary of his, training as an architect, a man called Philip Webb, who really became the greatest British architect of the arts and crafts movement. Mm. And then he thought he'd be a painter, and his one great large finished painting is of Jane Burden, the working class woman whom he married, and that could be found in the Tate. He was studying with, he became a great friend of Dante Gabriel Rossetti. He was studying with him, but he felt that that was not working out either. And he then moved to London, and he and Burne Jones were sharing a flat in Queen Square, and they simply Morris did not like the furniture that it was available for purchase. And with wonderful characteristic, he felt that anybody could do anything, that genius was not a real characteristic, but rather talent. He felt, I fear somewhat optimistically, that everybody, I'm sure it's not true of myself, that everybody is talented and everybody could be a designer. As I say, he was an extraordinary man who felt that other people shared his qualities, which, of course, sadly, was frequently not true. So he designed his own furniture. And then he also, when he got married, he wanted a house. And so he didn't design the house, but he made suggestions. And Philip Webb designed Red House, which was built in 1859, which is an incredibly important house. It's just been acquired by the National Trust and is available so one can see it quite easily. So he felt the world as he found it was not to his liking in terms of its looks, and therefore he himself would change it. And so he founded a firm in 1866, I think it was. He founded a firm with Rossetti and Ford Madox Brown and others, and Burne Jones, a design firm to make the world better looking. But he became increasingly convinced that for the world, for Britain and the world in general, to become a better place, that it would also have to change politically, that good design was not enough.
And before we go into that, this firm, originally called Morris, Marshall, Faulkner & Company, later morphed into Morris & Company, why was the design work of that firm so groundbreaking? Was it primarily because the use of natural materials, the handmade quality of it, the sort of painstaking detail of its methods, or was there something about the aesthetics itself that really...
Well, the thing is, Morris designs to a modern eye look somewhat complicated. But in contrast, particularly Martin Chapman mentioned the Great Exhibition of 1851, where there's an apocryphal story. I think Morris was then, if I've done the math right, was approximately 16. Allegedly, he refused to go in, but he must have seen illustrations of it. And if you look at Victorian furniture, it is unbelievably ornate. And the reason for its ornateness is it's saying about the purchaser that the purchaser can afford it and that the purchaser is getting a lot for the money. Morris just hated that, and he wished to have simple design. Morris's objects were not cheap, and particularly if they're handcrafted, they're very expensive. And the actual participation of his own workers perhaps was not ideal, and Morris was aware of that paradox. But he also he just felt it was important to have much simpler designs, and as you say, natural. This was a period in which there were these horrible, garish chemical dyes. There's in the Berger collection, which was originally in Berkeley, then in Carmel, and now belongs in the Huntington Library. There's a wonderful book, a unique book called the Morris Dye Book, where there are the recipes for the dyes, and you know they're using natural herbs and whatever to manufacture these dyes. He was anti-chemical. He said those colors are bad, those colors are ugly. We want to bring out the natural. We don't want something to look like what it isn't. We want it to look intensely like what it is. And that was his ideal. And so it was an extraordinary, it's very important, it seems to me, in the sort of history of modernism to move towards simpler lines, to get to the reality that's within the object, rather than imposing decorative things that demonstrate the wealth of the purchaser.